Coming up on Tech News Weekly, we explored the awesomeness that is this year's IFA. Also, Theranos is officially dissolving, finally. Twitter and Facebook take to Capitol Hill. Google's going to sit this one out. And AI for healthcare, it has a few big holes. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 48, recorded Thursday, September 6th, 2018. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean, the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications. Over 150,000 businesses rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/TNW.
Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is a show where every week we talk to the people making or breaking the tech news. I am Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell.
The mail just came.
Oh, really? What is that? What is that?
I got a little invitation. I think it's for you.
Oh, is this for me?
You. Yeah, it's for you.
Oh, it says you, G. Are invited to attend the Google announcement. This looks official.
It really looks like the real deal. Yeah, it did not get drawn by Burke and his Sharpie.
Definitely not the product of a Burke. No, apparently the Google product announcement is now officially scheduled for, what is it, October 9th mm-hmm. in New York?
It didn't say that on your invite?
No. The invite is very spare, barren. But here's an official pen to, I guess, scribble that in. So we'll do that. Oh, see, that's all it takes. All right, I guess I'm going.
Okay. All right, so just back from IFA, the big tech conference in Berlin, Devendra Hardawar is here to tell us about everything he saw there. Welcome back to the show, Devendra.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Did you get your personalized Google invite?
I did not. I'm feeling a little left out right now. I'm sure somebody did it. I don't really do as much phone stuff anymore.
You can just take this. I don't need it. Yeah.
I mean, you're probably glad that you're not going.
Yeah. Yeah. There are some things I don't get invited to, and I'm okay with that. It's just too crazy. Yeah.
But you did get to go to IFA. We should start by telling people what IFA is and whether or not you should ever pronounce it IFA.
I don't know if you should pronounce it IFA. I've only heard IFA. Okay. There is a long German, official name for it. It's basically the CES of Europe. And it's just like a big gathering. It's a good international gathering, too, because it's right there smack dab between, America and Asia as well. So a lot more companies. There's a much more international scene there than what we see at CES. So that's basically it's the big mid-year shindig.
Now, is that to say that it's not as relevant to the United States? I know, like, as far as phones are concerned, a lot of those phones don't end up making it to the U.S. Is that same for other technology that's shown off there?
It's kind of a mixture. There's definitely a lot of news. Like, we saw a lot of laptop news that'll end up here in America, I think, and some phone news as well. But there are huge markets outside of North America, too, where a ton of things get announced. I do Computex as well. That's usually in July. And that's an Asian big thing in Taiwan. And, again, most of those products we don't see. And then still some PCs we do. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so should I burn my 4K TV? Is it old technology now that that you saw some 8K TVs there?
That's really, I think, what the tech companies will want us to say, especially at CES. Like, it's going to be a big thing. I certainly don't think so. I wrote a whole thing about this in Gadget. But the leap from 4K to 8K just really isn't that huge. And honestly, even the leap between 1080p and 4K isn't that big on the resolution alone. With 4K, we got HDR. We got like a wider color gamut. We got a lot of other picture technologies that makes everything look better. And right now, 8K is just the resolution bump and not something you'll even notice, like if your TV is under 100 inches and if you're sitting, couch distance away. So I don't even know if that's ever going to have a role in the home. But yeah, we saw a couple sets get announced. Samsung said that they were bringing 8K QLED sets. And LG showed off their 8K OLED, which we saw at CES, but now it's kind of actually running. So it's more real than it's ever been, even though we've seen these demos before.
So I remember it wasn't very long ago. I mean, it was long ago enough when HD was just starting, and like to, you know, to conceive of a TV that's 50 inches in your living room seemed like a really big deal. Like the first time I saw a 50 inch TV, I felt like I was almost at a movie theater. And now we've gotten so accustomed to it. But a big reason for those large sets was because HDTV as a standard seemed to make those larger sets not look like mud. It looked actually really nice when you had good HD content. You're talking about 8K requiring a much larger screen. Do you envision in the future that we're all going to have 100 inch screens in our living rooms? Because that's the way that 8K, that's basically the road that 8K has paved.
Yeah, I don't think we do it just for 8K, but honestly, so in my living room, I have a 4K OLED, which is beautiful. It's 55 inches. And then when I want to watch a movie, I turn on my projector. It's still 1080p HD, but it spits out, you know, a 100-inch image. And that is so engulfing and so cinematic. And I still prefer watching movies on that rather than my brand new 4K set. Yeah. So there is something to be said for a large image. I think 4K, you know, in the home will probably be the standard for a long while. Even in theaters right now, like most of those digital projectors are just 4K and they still look fantastic. 8K will probably have a bigger home in theaters where you're looking at a much, you know, huge screen, and you're looking at it much more closely than you are, you know, at home. So yeah, I do think big screens, they're getting cheaper. Just look at it. Like you could get a 55 inch, TCL great 4K set for around, you know, $500 to $600 today. The 65 inch sets are around 1,000. OLED is getting down in price. We're looking at micro LEDs, which is the new technology Samsung and LG are pursuing, and those are meant to be huge. So I think something like that, I could see becoming standard down the line. Yeah.
And what about all the people that insist on watching Netflix on their phones? Like, what?
I can't help them. Yeah. Don't talk to me, please.
8K on your phone? Is that?
Oh yeah.
Is this where we're headed?
I don't know. Certainly 4K on phones right now seems kind of useless too, because you can't see those pixels. It doesn't really matter. But if we're using our phones as mobile VR headsets, maybe that becomes more important. I think more mobile 4K screens will be more useful outside of phones, probably in like a standalone, you know, VR headset of some kind. And that makes a huge difference because your eyes are just right up against the screen. You're just staring at all those pixels.
I need to talk about something much more practical. The water-powered eye massager that you tried.
Yeah, it's super cool. This is a thing. We've seen it before. It's from RI. And there are many eye massagers out there. But, you know, oh, that video is not working. There are many eye massagers out there. This one just uses a bit of water to kind of move through the membranes of the face mask. And it's like a nice massaging motion. It's very nice. I really dig it. I have never tried an eye massager before, but now I really want one. Yeah.
So it's not shooting water into your eyeballs.
No. Although your eyes do get a little damp, I think, just by being so close to something like that. But it's kind of refreshing. Sometimes when I go to the barber, you know, they throw a hot towel on my face once everything is over, and they give me like a nice head rub and eye rub, and that feels good. This is almost like that.
So maybe your eyes were getting damp because you were just so like brought to tears with the experience.
It's just beautiful.
I don't know. There's a striking similarity to this and VR headsets. And I will tell you, I will attest, and you know all about this, Devendra, that my eyes even get damp when I'm, you know, playing VR for too long because you get that hot face experience. So it's just probably a little more pleasant.
Yeah, with VR, my eyes either get sweaty or like really dry because it feels like you're just holding them open like Clockwork Orange style,
yes.
I think.
Yes, undoubtedly.
Someone in our chat room wonders if perhaps they were stealing your retina scans, you know, to just use for biometrics.
I don't know, but your eyes are closed, right?
Oh, yeah. Are your eyes closed?
Yeah.
Your
eyes are closed. Eyes are closed during this whole thing. Okay. It's a really nice meditative experience. Who knows what kind of biometric data they could get from this. Right now, it just seems like a, you know, nice chill headset.
Interesting. So one thing that caught my eye, and I saw this and then realized you actually got to sit in it, the Acer Predator Thronos cockpit, which I don't know. Like, I don't know what to think of this. Like, who is it even for? And like, explain it a little bit.
I think this is peak gamer, like just peak gamer excess.
Yeah.
It is for, you know, the main character of Ready Player One or something, right? It is this weird, it's a gamer chair, but it also has this like scorpion tail hood above it that lowers above you and puts three huge
screens.
Yeah. It's very mechanical. You can maneuver the entire chair, but also the arm for the displays is pretty fantastic too. But yeah, it's so weird. It is just so weird. It's like a whole gaming experience right there. You don't have to like set it up at your table, right? It's a whole moving table basically.
Wow. Okay. So, and I mean, the analog to this, or the layman's version of this, is just a desk with three widescreen kind of curved monitors around you.
Yeah.
Is the only differentiator here that you're sitting in a throne and looking slightly up?
That's pretty much it. It's a typical like motorized leather chair.
Okay.
And then it's just kind of all around you. It could be space saving for some people, even though it looks so huge. It could be great for arcades. They're not talking about pricing or availability yet. It just seems like one of those things that exists because they could do it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so you didn't see this at IFA, but you wrote about it on Engadget. The Roomba that contains a Roomba that empties itself.
Yo, dog, they put a vacuum in your vacuum. Yeah.
Tell us about that. I mean, it's not available yet, but tell us what we can expect.
Yeah, that's the Roomba i7 Plus, and I've been a big fan of Roombas forever. Honestly, I got one like way back around like 2004 or 2005, when basically all they could do is just like go around and be vacuums. This new one has the mapping technology that they had in the 980, the last big model, but the charging base can suck up the air from, can suck up the lint bin from the Roomba and just store it. So you don't have to do anything. You don't even have to pick up the Roomba and get it dirty. It just kind of does it all for you. It's amazing.
It is amazing because I have a Neato robotics vacuum and I love it, but then I'll forget to empty it and then it doesn't work. So it's like I have it set and then I get a message on my Apple Watch saying, I'm stuck, empty me, but I'm already at work. And it's like the Stone Age or something.
Yeah.
How do you live?
It's insane. But yeah, this is like a step towards automated cleaning. And it's something I use Roombas all the time as well. I can't just like let it go because I have to go find it and unload it. And then you get dirt all over you. You get dust all over you. This has like a self-contained bag. You just pull that out after like 30 cleans, which should technically last you a couple of months, I guess. And that's it. You put in a new one. The only thing is those are disposable bags. So you have to keep buying them from Roomba. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. But you have to buy filters for the Roomba regularly, right?
I feel like most people don't do that. I kind of just wash mine out. But yes, you do have to occasionally buy new ones as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm waiting for the Roomba that can actually climb up my stairs and go to the top and then do the upstairs that's carpeted versus the downstairs is hardwood. So, I have high expectations.
That's all. Just two Roombas. I actually think you could probably do that, too, if you had one Roomba and maybe two of these bases and just kind of, change the location every day or something.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because it has mapping. So if you were to take it to a different location, it would probably know where it's at that point.
Hopefully, it's pretty cool, too. The mapping, they had it before, but now it's like more advanced. So you can set up, you can tell it where the rooms are in your house. And with like a Google Home command, you could just say, please clean the kitchen and it'll do that. So that's pretty cool.
That is very cool. Mm-hmm. Well, Devendra, thanks as always for joining us. Devendra writes about technology, writes about movies and TV and vacuums for Engadget.
Everything. Whatever's cool.
Whatever's cool. And you can find him at Devendra on Twitter. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
According to an email sent to shareholders this week, blood testing company Theranos will pay creditors its remaining cash and then cease to exist. Joining us to talk about this is tireless Wall Street Journal reporter and author of the book Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. Welcome, John Carreyrou.
Welcome.
Greetings.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I know you just came from CNN and doing an interview there. Everybody wants to talk to you, obviously, because you've been following this story from the very beginning. You basically were the first to question Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. And then the last time we spoke, was right before federal prosecutors filed indictments against Elizabeth Holmes and Sunny Balwani. So what happened that precipitated the company's dissolution this week?
Right. I mean, the writing was actually on the wall. I thought personally, based on what I'd been told, that the company would go bankrupt in late July or August. So it took a little bit longer than I thought. But there was no doubt that this was going to be the outcome. This company has not had any revenues to speak of since 2015. And even in 2015, the revenues were nominal in the single digit millions of dollars. You know, when my first story came out, my first front page investigative story about Theranos came out in October of 2015, the company still had more than $400 million in the bank. It could have, you know, decided to return that money pro rata to investors, you know, saying, hey, we've just been found out, our shenanigans have been exposed, here's the money back, investors. And Elizabeth Holmes could have apologized to everyone, especially patients who were put in harm's way. But that's not the course of action that she chose. She chose to use that money to pay lawyers to hide the ball and to try to ward off lawsuits over the past almost 3 years. And what it did is it did forestall for a while the inevitable outcome, but it didn't prevent it. And now that inevitable outcome has come to pass, which is that she and her ex-boyfriend and the ex number two of the company have been indicted and face criminal trials and prison times of up to 20 years each. And Theranos is going concerned is being dissolved and will cease to exist.
I think what kind of blows me away in all this, and I know I've heard other people ask this question, and I think you're kind of alluding to it there, is this idea that the charges and the investigation kind of reached its pinnacle. We know that they're guilty. We know what they've done. Yet the company does continue to exist for however many months beyond that. Like, what on earth was even left to operate at that point? Like, were they just operating on money they still had set aside? Why wasn't that reappropriated to maybe pay back the investors? I just don't understand why they continued to exist beyond that.
Right. To be perfectly fair, they did. She did hire a new management team. They did try to continue development work on the last iteration of the blood testing device called the Mini Lab. They tried to work toward getting FDA approval for one or two assays, namely the Zika blood test. And unfortunately, there was never, I mean, the development never got to a point where the Mini Lab was reliable, even for the Zika assay with capillary blood prick from the finger. And this is now, you know, 2018, 5 years after they went live, supposedly with their great technology. But also, I think, you know, people at the FDA would never have approved anything from Theranos with Elizabeth Holmes still as CEO. And she remained as CEO and, you know, only stepped down once she was forced to in mid-June when the criminal indictments became public. And there was just no chance that this company was going to make it with her remaining as CEO. And yet, you know, this farce of a board continued to stand by her, and some employees continued to work there and draw paychecks and try to do work. But there was no doubt in my mind or in any sophisticated observer's mind that this was going to be the outcome, that the company would have to fold and that the top two who perpetrated this fraud would face justice.
Well, based on your research of what they actually did create, do you think they could have survived if she had stepped down, if they had a board that had kicked her out, you know, like Steve Jobs or, you know, any of the many men who've been kicked out of, you know, founders that have been kicked out of their companies? Could they have survived based on what they created?
I think they would have had more of a chance at survival if she had stepped down immediately. And I'm talking like October 16th. My first story was published October 15th. That would have given them almost 3 years between then and now to try to make progress on the Mini Lab prototype. Even so, I'm not convinced that this technology, first of all, you know, that there's any real big need for it. Because if you go back to Elizabeth Holmes's, you know, glory days in 2013, 14, 15, her claim was that she had invented a semi-portable device that could do any lab test, meaning hundreds of blood tests from just... Actually, Mini Lab is it's not really that. The Mini Lab is just miniaturizing about four or five different laboratory instruments that have been around for decades and putting them in one box. And to this day, 5 years after going live in Walgreens stores, they have not proven or shown or come close to showing that this mini lab contraction works with a tiny sample of capillary blood. So what you're left with is a machine that, you know, can do various types of tests on a sample of blood, a regular sized venous sample, but it has a terrible throughput. You know, one tests, just conducting one test takes like 2 or 2.5 hours. And there are machines, you know, made by big diagnostic equipment makers that can not only do these tests in minutes, but can do can test hundreds of samples at once. And so the mini lab as it is now is far, very far from the technology that she had claimed to invent.
So there's a large number, a reasonable size number of pretty notable investors that, you know, in the end got it wrong with this bet. I guess that's the world of venture capital. But when you're talking about VC funding, you know, there's a level of due diligence. And it really seems like, to a certain degree, that due diligence wasn't done properly. How could it have been so severely lacking amongst all of the investors that were involved here?
Right. Well, there's two answers to that. One is that the investors who were defrauded really were the investors who came in the last round of funding that began in early 2014 and spanned 2014 and 15. And that's when the company raised most of its money. It raised more than $700 million of the nearly billion that it raised over its lifetime in 2014 and 15. And it raised that money from, you know, what I would uncharitably call the dumb money, meaning the family offices of billionaires. These were not sophisticated Silicon Valley venture capital firms, and certainly not any sophisticated venture capital firms that had experience investing in the life sciences and in medical technology. So that's one explanation. The other is that the failure of due diligence really started with Walgreens back in 2010 when Theranos reached out to Walgreens and made its claims, and Walgreens took those claims at face value and eventually let Theranos roll out its blood tests in its stores in Northern California and Arizona. And amazingly, Walgreens, you know, this upstanding Fortune 500 company that's been around for 100 years based in Chicago, did not kick the tires and did not do any real due diligence, even though they at one point hired a consultant to help them do diligence, but they froze him out of the process. The reason that failure of due diligence at Walgreens is so important is that when the test became live, Elizabeth Holm was able to tell the last round of investors, the family office of the billionaires that put in $700 million, she was able to go to them and say, look, obviously our product works. We're in Walgreens stores. We've commercialized the product. Mm. You know, there's no risk here. There's no doubt. And so they relied on, in effect, on Walgreens' say-so. And of course, Walgreens had failed to do its homework.
And a large part of your book is dedicated to all the other reasons why people invested in her, from, you know, they were the father of her childhood best friend. You know, it was because she was a woman. It was because Silicon Valley wanted, you know, a female Steve Jobs. And it was because of paternalism. Like, a lot of men saw this, that, you know, they were father figures and they were going to give to her. It's so complicated. That's what makes your book so amazing. And they're still making the movie, right?
Right. Vanessa Taylor, who co-wrote The Shape of Water with Guillermo del Toro, is working on the screenplay. And the plan is still for Adam McKay to direct and produce, and for Jennifer Lawrence to co-produce and to star as Elizabeth Holmes.
Nice. And so do you think that they'll, like, will you write more of the story? Like, will this part be included, or do you think it'll end at the end of your book?
Oh, no, I think the arc of the, I mean, I don't have any say in the screenplay, although Vanessa does consult with me quite a bit. I definitely think the arc of the story portrayed in the movie will go as far as it can And if a trial has taken place by then, and if there's an outcome to the trial, I expect that to be part of the movie too.
Well, as I said when we talked, it's the only thing I don't like about your book is that it's true. I wish it were a novel. I wish it were fictional, because there's so many. I mean, we laugh about it, but like, this was people's health that, you know, she lied about, and that many other people lied about too. So, thank you for writing the book. Thank you for joining us, John Carreyrou, one of the first reporters to question the Theranos hype, and the author of Bad Blood: Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you, John.
Thanks.
All right. Coming up, big tech goes to Capitol here. I'm sure you already heard a lot about this. We've got more insight on that. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean provides the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications with droplets, virtual machines that are scalable compute platforms with add-on storage, security, and monitoring capabilities. You can actually choose from standard or CPU-optimized droplets, and then you can customize from there to make it your own. DigitalOcean is designed for developers. Developers are going to hear a lot that's going to make their ears perk up here. The easy-to-use control panel and API that actually lets developers spend more time coding, the thing they would like to do, less time managing their infrastructure needs. Industry-leading price to performance. You can access the compute resources you need at the lowest rates, saving up to 55% compared to other cloud providers. And you'll always know what you'll pay per month because of flat pricing structure across all data center regions. Makes it easy to understand. Included at no additional cost, you get 99.99% uptime SLA, cloud firewalls, monitoring and alerting, full DNS management, global data centers. There's enterprise SSDs, an easy-to-use API. Like I've said before, over 150,000 businesses, including some of the world's fastest-growing startups, rely on DigitalOcean, and that's to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. And you can be part of that as well. Sign up today, and you'll receive a free $100 credit. Just go to do.co/TNW. That's do.co/TNW, and you'll get a free $100 credit. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support. So I was yesterday I was hosting This Week in Google in Leo's absence, and someone was missing from the panel, someone who I knew would have plenty of thoughts on what I've been calling the tech reckoning. It's kind of an ominous name, as Twitter and Facebook bigwigs headed to Washington, D.C. To kind of atone for their ineffective handling of misuse on their networks. That man is Jeff Jarvis, professor at the CUNY School of Journalism, and he joins us here today. Welcome, hey. Jeff. How are you doing?
All right. How are you?
Awesome. It's great to get you on here. There's so much ground to cover, and we were talking about it yesterday, and I was like, I know Jeff's got thoughts on this. Absolutely. So this is your chance. So we saw Jack Dorsey and Sheryl Sandberg sit in the hot seat during this congressional hearing. What would you say has been the tone of the questions that were thrown at them, and how do you think they did in responding?
I was surprised, because I was very nervous, given prior hearings were all about seeing just how stupid our legislators are about the internet and how hostile they were. I think that it was a very different tone, except, of course, to Google, which we'll get to in a minute. But I think that the legislators were giving credit to Facebook and Twitter for trying, for moving ahead. They probably want to take credit for that. You know, we put you on the hot seat and you responded. Fine, whatever. I think there was a bit more of a sense of pulling the oars in the same way. I saw most of the testimony. There was a chunk in the middle I missed, so there could have been some horrible moment that I missed. But all in all, I thought that the questions were respectful. And in terms of Sandberg and Dorsey, I think they both did very well. The only thing I wish they'd done was to remind people that the internet is not a flaming cesspool of crap. That most of the internet is wonderful. Good things happen. Social media enables Black Lives Matter and Me Too to occur. But that's my wishful thinking. I think what they did in all was accomplish the goal of saying, we're trying. We care about this too. We want to work together. The fact that Congress came back and said, if there are things that are stopping you from working together, let us know. So I was quite pleasantly surprised.
Hmm. What did you think about Google's retort when it sent in an empty chair to speak on its behalf? What did you think about that? Was this a smart decision on Google's part? Yesterday on Twig, Stacey seemed to think that it really didn't matter much that whether Google sent someone or not, that they were making a statement that ultimately it wasn't going to matter as much. I'm definitely paraphrasing, but what's your thought?
Yeah, I think Stacey, as usual, is right. I was thinking about this yesterday. Will it matter in a month that Google wasn't there? No. Will people say, oh, my God, Google didn't come before this hearing? No, I don't think so. Though, and so going into it, I thought, yeah, Google may win this test because what the heck? They're going to get skewered. They're going to have idiotic questions. Nothing's going to be accomplished. Google's smart not to be there. That was my impression going in. But given that the hearings turned out better than I thought, I think Google missed an opportunity to be there. And further, because Google was not there, it was an opportunity for various senators. One in particular went after them for, you know, maybe being nice to China, for not continuing the drone projects with the U.S. government. And so Google got smashed a little bit and didn't have an opportunity to respond. So in the end, I was wrong. I think that Google would have been wiser to be there, but I certainly understand why Google chose not to be.
I was surprised that Kamala Harris was there. She was kind of busy yesterday. She's been busy in the last few days. I mean, that she was there to question Sandberg and ask, like, how much money have you made? How much money has Facebook made off of, you know, these Russian ads? I mean, what did you make of her questions and her being there and also at the Supreme Court hearings?
Yeah, but she is our prosecutor extraordinaire, and I don't want to face her, man. I don't want to do anything wrong and see Kamala Harris staring at me. I've met her; she's a very nice person. But boy, if I've done anything wrong, keep me safe, because she is tough. But I think I didn't get to watch all of that. I got interrupted by a phone call in the middle of it. I think it's a bit of a bogus idea to say that the platforms want this manipulation and trolling because they make money off of it. It's bad for their brands. It's bad for their businesses. They're getting hauled forward before people because of just that stuff. So I think it's naive, purposefully naive, to say that they're making money. You know, this also goes back to when Al Franken pushed them in earlier hearings. And rubles! You should have seen the rubles! which, when you realize the scale of this, is absolutely absurd. I was struck again yesterday by the sheer scale of this. I tweeted it. I don't have the number in front of me, but Jack Dorsey said that I think that they were killing like something like 7 million fake accounts a week. Sheryl Sandberg said, and this goes beyond what they said at F8. At F8, Zuckerberg said they were killing 1 million accounts a day. And she said yesterday they're killing millions of accounts a day. When you're dealing at that scale, rubles are not going to pop up before your attention. And this isn't about them making money. That's a cynical question in the end, because they don't want this on their back. And you know, what they really want, I think, is cover to be able to take things down. Right before we came on the air, Twitter did announce that they're taking down Alex Jones.
Yeah.
That's been a very difficult thing for them to come to. The other platforms did. What they all needed was company. They needed each other to say, you first? No, you first. And they're doing it. And there's still some controversy about it. Of course, Lord knows there will be. But in the end, I think that though I was one who was rather dogmatic about openness and more speech is good speech and so on and so forth, I've come to see that was naive. These bad guys are manipulating the platforms. They're using them. And the platforms are not getting anything positive out of this. They're getting nothing but headaches and, importantly, huge expense. You know, Sandberg also said yesterday it wasn't future tense anymore. She said present tense that they have 20,000 people working on this. And I've used this bad analogy before, and it is a bad analogy. But there are 20,000 people at Facebook now assigned and paid to hunt down and get rid of crap detectors. Meanwhile, in the United States, we have, and it's an apples to kumquats comparison, we have about 30,000 journalists on daily newspapers. And so what does that say about our allocation of resources that we have to these two worlds, to quality news, to playing whack-a-mole with crap? And what it also says is that the investment in dealing with the crap in human labor and in algorithm writing and in getting data sets is huge. And full disclosure, I should mention here, because it's a different show from usual, is that I raised money from Facebook, Craig Newmark, Ford Foundation, and others to start the News Integrity Initiative at CUNY. I am independent of them, and I personally receive no money from any platform. End of disclosure.
So Peter Kafka yesterday, he tweeted a picture of empty seats during the House hearing. Did the reps like have better things to do? Is that what it usually looks like in there? Like it was pretty empty.
Yeah, it is. It's what happens. They have other things to go do, and it's all for the camera. So I don't think it's a huge deal. Did you also see, by the way, Jack's tweet about his pulse?
Yes.
I should have said it into you earlier. I don't have it at the ready, but it was very funny that you know, he started off by saying that he was shy. I love that the head of Twitter says, "I'm a man of few words." Of course you are.
Yeah.
And a few more now, but still a few. But he, you know, he's not used to doing this. He's not that kind of public figure, and I think that he comported himself well. And Sheryl Sandberg is often accused of being too scripted and too this. I think she too came off very well. I think she came off as quite sincere.
All right. So along with this, man, the last couple of days have just been nutso. There was news that Attorney General Jeff Sessions, you know, and of course we heard about, you know, President Donald Trump saying that Google is actively censoring conservative voices. Jeff Sessions then there was news that he had been meeting with state attorneys general on this topic of platform censorship. Does it seem like there's a march that's pretty hard to steer away from right now towards regulation of these platforms? I mean, so many things are happening all at once, right? We've got election interference. We've got charges of censorship. All these things concurrently happening. Is regulation just like almost a given at this point? What do you think?
Lord, I hope not. And at moments like this, I sound like a libertarian. I enrage some Twit fans because I'm a proven liberal. I'm not against government, but I am against government involvement in speech. I think that it would be a big mistake. Number one, and the internet is speech, period. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. Two, I think we've seen in Europe that the regulation that's occurred there, though well-intentioned, has huge unintended consequences. GDPR, the privacy regulation, means that a couple thousand U.S. publishers have now cut off Europe. The right to be forgotten gives more power to Google to decide what should and should not be remembered, which I think is a frightening idea. The NetzDG hate speech law in Germany, besides hiring thousands of people to Facebook, means that satire is all but dead because it gives companies 24 hours to get stuff off. So they're going to play safe and take anything that's edgy off. Those are problems. Those are big problems. And I don't want to see that occur. And I do think that we've got to recognize that we are on the same side. Let me give a caveat to that in a second. And I'll say something controversial, so I already apologize to your email accounts. but we have to see here now that Twitter particularly, Facebook particularly, also Twitter and also Google are our best allies and our best defense against Russian election interference. Our own government, the United States, is not a good defense. Right? We have major officials starting at the very top saying, Russia? What Russia? Nothing's happening here. And so we've got to recognize, number one, that they are trying to defend us now that they know about it. Number two, when you have Donald Trump going after Google, the same way he has in the past declared the press to be the enemy of the people, he's going after sources of information. He's going after sources of truth and reporting. And so that he has the only truth. Or as Rudy Giuliani says, truth isn't true. So we're in that kind of boat where media and the platforms, which are not the same, I would argue, are on the same side. They're on the same side of fighting manipulation and interference. They're on the same side of trying to inform the public and give people access to information. They're on the same side when it comes to being attacked by authoritarians in this country and elsewhere. So the media, what disturbs me so often is that media has become dystopian and moral panicky about the platforms and is taking pride in smashing them at every turn. Well, folks, they're not the enemy.
I need to go back to what you said about the internet being speech. The internet is speech. You didn't say, you know, free speech is so complicated. Every time I feel like I say, you know, something about free speech, people say, like, you don't understand free speech. Free speech is not free. And what do you mean by the internet is speech?
So, watch out. I'm going to go on for an hour.
I know I was in trouble asking this question, but I really need to know.
No, so this is a post that I haven't written yet that I want to write.
Please do.
Which is that, after you hear it, you may disagree.
Okay.
I think that we in media make a mistake, and people in government make a mistake of seeing the internet as content. That's viewing the future in the analog of the past. That's Gutenberg terms. Drinking game, whenever I say Gutenberg, yep, you can take a swig. And that sees the world as containers of something called content. That's not what the internet is. The internet is Times Square, not the New York Times. The internet is a place where people come together to connect with each other and with information and to take action and to do things and to buy things. And pardon me, my lights go out because it thinks that I'm dead. technology. And so just in the middle of my spiel, the lights are editors. I think that to presume that the internet is content also brings other assumptions with that, which including, well, it ought to be edited. Well, it ought to be packaged. It ought to be censored. It ought to be approved. It ought to be perfect. None of that is true. It's just people talking. The fact that anyone who's connected can talk to anyone who's connected. We got a lot more people to connect, but we're headed there. That's very different from saying that a small elite has access to the press and access to create a product we call content that they can publish, I don't know, in something like a book.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very different beast. So I think that we keep on saying that the internet is media. It's not. That the internet is content. It's not. The internet is people talking. And we wouldn't go around Times Square. We wouldn't go to the neighborhood Denny's. And when somebody says something stupid in the next booth, say, stop saying that. You shouldn't say that. That's wrong. I'm going to correct you. Right? We just know people talk. They do what they do. And we've got to see the internet in that context. And we've got to appreciate it for that, that we can now hear voices that couldn't be heard before. Without the internet, we wouldn't have had, as I said, Me Too or the Parkland students' victories. We also wouldn't, as a white person, I wouldn't be as aware as I am now of the problems of white people calling the cops on black people who are just living their lives while black. It's been going on, God, Lord knows, for as long as since we've had a telephone. But I wasn't aware of it as much as I should have been because it wasn't documented by media. It wasn't a story in media. It wasn't content. Instead, now we have a medium that enables people to talk. Now, having said that, why do I also celebrate taking down Alex Jones? Because there are standards in society, and society is negotiating those standards. And society has told Twitter and Facebook and company that Alex Jones, we don't know where the line is, but whatever that line is, he's on the other side of it. And the platforms would like us to have rules that they can put into algorithms, but unfortunately it's not as clean as that. And it means that we as society are doing this anecdotally. And we've said Alex Jones is unacceptable in a civilized world. Get him out of there. At the same time, I'm arguing it's speech and I want as much speech as possible. Those are conflicting.
Yeah.
And we're trying to figure out where those lines are.
Yeah, absolutely.
So before your lights go out again, write the internet is speech, write the post, write the book. Just, you have to write the book very fast.
I am working on that. Okay. Gutenberg.
or you can write that in a dark office. Just make sure your keyboard's backlit.
Yeah.
That's all. I have a wonderful Chromebook, so it's okay.
All right. Fantastic. Jeff Jarvis, it's always great getting the chance to talk to you, and I'm happy
always
we got your insight on this buzzmachine.com. Absolutely. We'll do it again soon. Thanks, Jeff. We'll see you next week on Twig. Bye. All right. Healthcare is transforming before our very eyes. We've talked about it a lot on this show, actually, in the past. Artificial intelligence is becoming more understood, obviously, and implemented into the healthcare industry. But it has some glaring blind spots that need to be addressed before it can truly be depended upon. And joining us to talk about whether AI is up to the healthcare task is Dave Gershkorn from Quartz. Welcome back to the show, Dave.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, you bet. It's great to see you again. So let's maybe start off with the potential here. Why in healthcare is AI, artificial intelligence, seen as such a game changer for the industry?
So the kind of the promise here is that you can have a doctor in your pocket,
right? So like you have a, you can maybe describe your symptoms to your phone and an algorithm in there might be able to sort through and come up with some sort of diagnosis that might say, oh, you should go see a specialist. Or maybe you take a picture of a skin lesion that you have and it could potentially tell you whether it's malignant or benign. So it's really taking the expertise of a doctor and putting it onto a machine. Likewise, in a doctor's office or a specialist's office, after you get a some sort of scan, like a CT scan or an X-ray, AI could be used to analyze that way quicker than a doctor would be able to, and then give the doctor some, like, you know, first blush advice on how to, you know, categorize the a lesion or a tumor, or see whether there's been a fracture in a bone. Basically just cut down a lot of the time, so maybe you don't have to make that follow-up appointment. So really it's kind of taking some medical expertise and taking the best of the best that we have and putting it into a machine's hands.
So that's a beautiful utopian view on what AI could possibly do for the healthcare industry. And I'm pretty certain we'll get there at some point. You're writing, of course, in this article that we're not there yet. It's falling short. What are some of the ways that it's kind of not working, this implementation is failing in that regard? What are some of those ways?
Yeah, so what I found was that it's when you look at the data that's available for these algorithms to learn from, they are based on a lot of the data that's been collected in medical studies. They are, you know, data sets that have been collected by researchers and have been made public, or they are data sets that have been released by hospitals that are kind of incomplete and over a short amount of time. And what you really see when you look at these data sets is that they reflect a lot of biases about the way that they were captured, the way the data was captured. So a lot of these people are from urban environments. A lot of them are maybe a little bit more wealthy. A lot of them are white, and a lot of them are male. And especially when we were looking at dermatology, you look at a lot of the open data sets, and a majority of the skin lesions are of people with white skin. And if you're training something to detect dermatological treatments, so like you want to know if a skin lesion is malignant or benign, which there have been quite a few papers on, if you do it on only white skin, the algorithm isn't going to know what to do with people with darker skin, and you're not going to have as accurate of a diagnosis. And that means, like, if you look at that for 10 people, maybe it's like at a doctor's office, so someone can get a second opinion. But if you're looking at the scale of, you know, 350 million Americans all using this app, and, you know, a certain percentage of that is people with darker skin, and they're not getting a accurate medical reading, then it's the problem is suddenly scaled to millions of people. And it's kind of like it's a kind of a double-edged sword. The best part about this algorithm is that it can be deployed to millions of people, but the worst part is that it can also, like, its biases can be deployed to millions of people.
So you have this great story in your piece about a lab that was working on facial recognition, not recently, but a while ago. And there was one black man in the lab, and everyone that was working on the facial recognition had to fix it because it didn't work on him. Like, all of their data sets, like you said, were with white people. And so he was in that room at that time. And, you know, you say that they fixed it because it was early on. But that doesn't happen as often as it needs to.
Totally. And I think that some of these systems might be kind of put together in a vacuum where they have the data that they have, and maybe it works on a small population, but people just don't really understand that this is too much of a problem yet. It's kind of also a weird time in this in the research for this, because there's definitely been research on bias in AI and people understand that it's a problem. But I don't think it really has made its way into the production pipeline yet, where people are really actively talking about bias, looking at their data sets for bias. There have been a bunch of companies that have been saying that they're going to look at this more, like Google and Microsoft, and IBM has been doing some research. But I don't think it's, you know, across the board. People are looking at, you know, do our demographics reflect what's actually, who the demographics and the data reflect the demographics of the user.
Yeah, and in all markets across the world, too. That seems like, man, that seems like a really difficult challenge to overcome. How might someone, you know, have a data set? How might they recognize the existence of bias within a data set? I mean, that sounds like a really large challenge, just identifying that.
Totally. And it really varies based on the kind of data set. If it's something like dermatology, that's something that we focused on because it was kind of very apparent, and that we had spoken with a few researchers and they said that their data sets were mainly very white and they really didn't know how it would act on a data set that was more diverse, which was kind of alarming to me. And that's kind of the thing that kicked off this whole story. But if you're talking about data that is trying to predict maybe more abstract facets of health, like your risk for diabetes, your risk for obesity, some sort of preventative measure, which is certainly in the pipeline in a lot of companies. I mean, bias can be found in your zip code. That's actually a huge tell, like about like your affluency, your race, even your age, your gender. So there are like little hidden biases found all over data sets. And really it's up to these companies to be employing data scientists who are looking for this. It's not an easy task every single time.
Well, we've been hearing about the human genome, you know, that we've learned so much from it, and it always seems so great that, you know, we're so smart. But there's problems there and bias within our research into genomics. Is that how you pronounce it, or genomics?
I think it's up to you.
Okay. Say genomics.
Everybody
Thank you,
wins.
Dave. talk a little bit about the problems that are popping up there.
Yeah. So there have been a few studies over the last decade or so that have looked into the genetic makeup of a lot of people that are typically included in genomic studies. And they have found that they are overwhelmingly of European descent. And that matters because genomics is kind of like the forefront for personalized medicine. And that's, you go to your doctor, they analyze your genome, they analyze, you know, a whole bunch of different facets about your lifestyle, how you live, you know, past medical history, your family's medical history, and then this kind of like unique fingerprint of you, which is your genome. And they recommend a specialized treatment. Now, that would be like great, and it sounds very utopian again, but if you only have people of European descent in your database, you can only be sure that your treatments and diagnoses are correct for people of European descent. And there have been shown to be like wide variation in the kinds of treatments that are applicable for people, especially when you're using like targeted genome treatments based on their genome. I mean, like there are reasons why certain medications are recommended for certain patients and certain medications are recommended for others. And typically that's at the doctor's discretion because they have years of medical training. But when you're getting this specific about the treatment, you really have to know the patient, and you don't know the patient if you don't have the data about them.
You write in your piece that kind of the ethical studies involved with artificial intelligence in healthcare should not be pushed to later because we're experiencing these challenges now. It should be addressed. You know, it probably should have already been addressed, you know, so that we're not dealing with what we're dealing with at this point. But do you see that as kind of a constant with AI in general? It seems like there is some talk about the ethical considerations of where AI leads the future. And there's certainly some very serious efforts being made in that discussion. But is this pretty standard for AI in 2018?
I think so. And I think it kind of speaks to where the entire AI space is right now. So if you look a few years ago, this was pretty much all research. Not a lot of deep learning was being put into production because it didn't really work yet. In 2012, that was when the big ImageNet competition happened. And that's when researchers really realized, hey, this thing could have some legs. And we spoke, I think, earlier about my story on that, about Dr. Fei-Fei Li, who kind of changed the world's mind about whether data was important or not. Spoiler alert, it is. So when – I'm sorry, can you remind me of the question again?
No, just the idea of ethics around AI.
Okay. Yeah. So ethics is, I think a lot of people don't, researchers want to just want to work on problems. They want to see if they can make this algorithm work. They want to see if they can detect cats. And when that's in the research space, it's you don't really need to worry about ethics that much. But now all these companies see the promise of it. They know that they can start making millions or billions of dollars off of selling these healthcare solutions. So they're switching it from research to production faster than ever before. And since this happened, I think that the industry has whiplash a little bit. They all these things that used to be just for research are getting transferred over to production really fast, which means that maybe there wasn't enough time for ethical review. And like, you know, there are some people doing it really right, like the FDA. They only, you know, it's been 6 years since kind of like the deep learning boom promised all of these crazy results. And they've only this year allowed the first AI-powered software to be marketed in the U.S. So some people are being cautious, but it's definitely time for ethics in AI to kind of take a more frontal role.
Yeah. I think a lot of people agree with that. Dave Gershkorn from Quartz, really appreciate you taking time. It's a great article. Everybody should definitely read through it. It's pretty dense, but thank you again. We'll talk to you soon.
Yep.
Take care.
All right, take care.
There's actually a whole series of articles that in Quartz.
They've got like, you know, they've really worked on kind of the layout and everything. So they like it kind of pulls you in a little bit more. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah,
good
there's one about mammograms that I am going to read right after we finish this show.
Right on.
You could read it too. But finally, we don't know if they're going to regulate Facebook or Twitter or anything else. But the good news, my friends, is your Shazamming will remain unregulated, at least in the EU. Back in April, the European Union Commission launched an investigation into Apple's purchase of song recognition software Shazam, claiming that the acquisition would give Apple an unfair advantage over other streaming services like Spotify. But after looking into the deal, the EU says Shazam has limited importance into the entrance into the music market. So just a reminder, when you Shazam something, you can buy that song from anywhere. I guess the idea was, you know, on your phone, if you Shazam something, if you say, what song is this playing? It does it automatically, right? On your Pixel or your Samsung?
Yeah, it's built into Assistant. Yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. And then it'll go to Google Play Music when you press it?
I don't know, because I never press it. Yeah. I just go, oh, that's the song. I think it actually gives you a little card, so it will take you there.
Yeah.
It might also give you like a Google search button if you want to find more information on it or whatever. But I mean, at least on the Pixel, there's also a feature that you can turn on where it's constantly showing you on the lock screen. If something happens to be playing, it will identify it and it will place it on your screen, which is amazing, which is a feature that I never thought I'd be that interested in, but I use it all the time. Mm-hmm. This just kind of seemed strange to me. Like, I guess I missed it back in December when Apple was buying Shazam, that there was any sort of possible antitrust consideration, because they don't do the same thing at all. Like, why?
Well,
it's not like they compete against each other.
I think the idea was that you would say, you know, what is this song? And then you click on it and you go and to you go buy right it in Apple. The iTunes store. But they don't know that nobody buys music anymore.
That's true.
Streaming everything. But that's no, that true. You would, so that it would compete so that you can, you know, I guess, does it use Shazam, the Pixel, or does it use some other technology that
no,
does
No, I
that?
Don't believe that it's Shazam on
So
Pixel.
I think what they decided was like, other people can do this. It's not, I guess, that difficult to realize. But I mean, I think that Spotify that goes through the Pixel? Anyway, Spotify also, I know, would use Shazam in some way too. So I think that was why they were afraid.
Oh, I see. Yeah, no, I don't think that Google or Assistant is using Shazam. I think they have their own thing going on in the background.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and it doesn't link up to Spotify either. I'm pretty certain of that.
Probably, yeah. So Shazam all over the place.
Yeah, to your heart's content.
Or just use a friend. Ask a friend what that song is. There's no antitrust among friends.
That's what they say. That's what they say. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday starting at 2:30 p.m. Pacific, 5:30 p.m. Eastern at twit.tv/live. You can always be part of the show by emailing us, tnw@twit.tv.
And subscribe to our show. You can do that at twit.tv/TNW. You can subscribe no matter where you listen or watch, whatever you do. I wish they had Shazam for podcasts. So, like, if I was talking, someone could be like, what podcast is this?
Oh.
We should work on that.
That's a nice
idea.
Let's add
it to our idea list.
That's an idea. That's our $1 million idea.
I know. And if you want to tweet at me and tell me what a horrible or wonderful idea that is, please do. I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to everyone who helps out. Today we've got Burke. We've got Victor. Jammer B was in here. Alex was in here scrambling right before the show. I think I stressed him out a little bit. Anyways, thanks to everyone who helps us do this show each and every week. And thanks to you for checking it out each and every week. We'll see you next time on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.